I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, learning about and learning from Anton Chekhov, the model doctor slash writer of pre-revolutionary Russia, the gentle diagnostician whose plays and stories ring true as never before about the human condition, maybe everywhere. Chekhov is famous for seeing missed opportunities and unlived lives all around him, the utopian dreams of good people who couldn't make good, as Nabokov said. That's not the whole story, but it's where we begin with a fragment from Chekhov's play Uncle Vanya from 1897 and the movie version of 20 years ago, Vanya on 42nd Street. Here is the doctor, played by Larry Pine, late at night with Wallace Shawn as the depressed Vanya in David Mamet's adaptation of the script.
I can say whatever I wish.
Well, you're not mad, you know. You're a fool. I used to think the foolish, the deranged, the irresponsible are sick. They're not sick, they're normal. You're quite well.
Oh, God. What am I gonna do?
Nothing.
I'm 47 years old. If I lived to be 60, I would have to live through 13 more years. How could I do that? How could I stand it? I have nothing to do with those years, you see? Nothing. I mean, if I could start anew, if I could live the rest of my life out in some different way, if that were possible, as people do, to wake, to awaken each day and say, this is a new day. If I could lose the past, how could a person do that? How could a person start anew and begin a new life?
Oh, will you shut up? To start anew. We cannot start anew, you or I. This or that we're living, you know, is our life.
It is.
Quite. People who live after us in 100 or in 200 years, you know what they'll feel? They'll despise us for our stupid and insipid lives. Perhaps they'll know how to be happy. We, however, but for you and I, there is but one hope, and that hope is this, that when we are dead, lying in our graves, visions may visit us, and that they are of peace. Oh, yes.
There are ecstasies in Chekhov, too, among his good-humored dreamers. And there is inspiration for a wide world of modern writers who take up the Chekhov standard, as we'll hear. Did I say, we've been podcasting our at-home readings of Chekhov stories with actors and other friends this past winter. The effect of encountering Chekhov, we found, just as his friend Gorky said, was a desire to be simpler, more truthful, more one's self. And so do we all this hour, with the novelist and story man Andrei Debuse III, a second-generation Chekhovian writer, also with the stage director Malia Bensusan, who produced The Cherry Orchard in Boston last winter, and with Maxim Schreier, who teaches Chekhov and the Russian masters at Boston College. Andrei, let's begin with you. What does it mean? First, let me just say there's a lot of Chekhov I read in your new book of novellas, Dirty Love. Hmm. But what does it mean to read and write and observe and teach as a sort of Chekhovian in our midst?
Well, first, thank you for that incredibly high compliment. First, and thank you for having me, Chris. Look, there's nothing about Anton Chekhov's work that I don't adore. And this is true of every writer. I have not met a writer who disagrees with this. I have not met a writer who does not love and or at least respect and admire what Chekhov
was up to. The exception is Ernest Hemingway, who learned everything from Chekhov, but also said he only wrote three or four great stories. But anyway, you're right.
I'd love to talk to Hemingway about that because he owes a great debt to Chekhov, I would argue, in many ways, and I'm a Hemingway lover too. I'd like to start with a little Flannery O'Connor, a little William Faulkner, two completely different writers who probably don't owe much debt to Chekhov. But I love what O'Connor said in her essay, The Nature and Name of Fiction. She said, "The artist's job is to make actual the mystery of our position on earth." That's it. Faulkner said, "The aim of every artist is to arrest motion, which is life, by artificial means and hold it fixed. so that 100 years later, when a stranger looks at it, it moves again, since it is life. You know, rereading Chekhov for this show was such a wonderful joy. I've been reading him consistently over the years, as most writers do, and most readers, every writer should. There's no artifice. This is the thing. You know, he's got this famous line about, and I quote this to my writing students, and I believe he said it, I don't know who he said it to, but here it is, that we short story writers should lop off the beginning of our stories and the ends of our stories, because those are the parts where we tend to lie the most. And so, look, there's so much to love about Chekhov. One of the things that I find just inspiring is, I think in 2014, you know, I was reading an article yesterday about a dear friend of mine, and he's a well-known novelist, and they're talking about his brand. And that is not what Chekhov was up to. You know, we live in a time where art and commerce is very muddy. And so tonight I'd like to talk about the art here of this man. One of the things I've noticed in teaching writing over the years, Kristen, you and I have talked about this before, is I've noticed a very interesting shift in the tools that young writers use in character development. So there are four basic direct tools that we use as fiction writers. One is what a character looks like, which includes what he drives, where he lives, his possessions. Two is what a character says or doesn't say. Three, of course, is, you know, a character's actions. I've seen so many young writers, it's not a criticism, it's an observation. You can get a lot done with those three writerly tools. You can write an entire story, actually, with those three. But if it's a lot like setting up a camera and just filming a scene. It's very filmic. It's very, and I think it comes from that world. So many young writers come into the classroom now inspired not from Chekhov stories or novels so much as film, TV, filmed stories, and video games, which maybe we can get to later. But the one tool that they are not using, and I implore them to use, is the one that I think sets apart writing from filmmaking. And no disrespect to my filmmaking brothers and sisters out there, they're artists all. But to me, it will never be able to do as an art form what literature can do in the right hands, for instance, with a man such as Chekhov, because it uses language. The fourth tool that we writers reach for in the toolbox is the interior lives of the characters. That is simply what literature does better than any art form I can think of in capturing the texture of human existence. And so what is there? Well, it's not just consciousness, it's our memories, it's our desires, it's our imaginings. You know, Aristotle's got that famous line from the Poetics that man is his desire. I want to read a brief passage, if I can, from Chekhov's most celebrated short story, The Lady with the Pet Dog. And just to make my point here about how deeply he goes into consciousness. And Chekhov uses place. I don't know if he did it consciously, but it's certainly part of his art. You could argue that his art would not exist without physical place. It is a huge, huge lever for what he does. I'm going to read just a brief scene from The Lady with the Pet Dog, if you don't mind.
Please. André de Bus, the third.
Okay, this is for those who do not know the story, basically our main character, Gurov, is a married man, works in a bank, is a bit of a scoundrel and a sexual predator, although Chekhov does not write with any of that judgment. That's my judgment as a reader. And he's out on the Yalta, and he's picking up another young married woman for his entertainment. Much to his surprise, they've had their tryst, and she's deeply remorseful, and he finds himself having a change towards her. At Orianda, they sat on a bench not far from the church, looked down at the sea, and were silent. Yalta was barely visible through the morning mist. White clouds rested motionlessly on the mountaintops. The leaves did not stir on the trees. Cicadas twanged, and the monotonous, muffled sound of the sea that rose from below spoke of the peace, the eternal sleep awaiting us. So it rumbled below when there was no Yalta, no Arianda here. So it rumbles now, and it will rumble as indifferently and as hollowly when we are no more. And in this constancy, in this complete indifference to the life and death of each of us, there lies perhaps a pledge of our eternal salvation, of the unceasing advance of life upon earth, of unceasing movement towards perfection. sitting beside a young woman who, when the dawn seemed so lovely, Gurov, soothed and spellbound by these magical surroundings, the sea, the mountains, the clouds, the wide sky, thought how everything is really beautiful in this world when one reflects. Everything except what we think or do ourselves when we forget the higher aims of life and our own human dignity. So there he is, right in the face of his own fallibility, his own flaws, and his own dark character. And it actually begins to have a change on him. And all young writers and not so young writers should read Chekhov just to see the importance of all this.
We got to talk when we come back with Melia Bensusan about how all of this inner life can be and is transmitted and delivered on stage too. Do you want to give us a quick preview? Oh, let me just ask Andre one question.
Yeah.
You talk about your students. Can you teach a Chekhovian approach? I mean, the way you might teach a Gershwin tune? I mean, is there a trick that you give your students or that they...
Boy, I don't know if I do it well at all, honestly, Chris. What I do is I simply rely upon... I've always believed if you're raised on Big Macs and someone puts a steak au poivre with a béarnaise sauce in front of you, you're going to know the difference. But I have seen time and time again that young people who have not necessarily come into the classroom reading literature do see the difference. You know, my approach is I want you to notice that he's not working really hard on entertaining us. He's okay. He could be very entertaining. He had a lot of humor. We'll talk about that too. But what he worked hard on doing is sifting to the true, true, true layers of the moment, and that's entertaining enough. In fact, it's transcendent.
The truth in Chekhov is a key thing. I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, the Chekhov Sessions. We spoke over Skype this week with Rosamund Bartlett, who's translated a lot of Chekhov and written his biography. She began with the point that his grandfather was a serf who had bought his family's freedom. His father was a merchant, not the class that produced Russian writers in general, but his father could afford to send his sons to school, and they all got good educations.
From a very early point, he felt he had to take some responsibility in his family because his father had gone bankrupt. His two elder brothers were ne'er-do-wells. They were both alcoholics and very reprobate. And Chekhov found himself having to provide financially for his family, so his younger sister, his younger brother, and his mother. And he, I think, because he knew he was going to die early too, he had this clarity about the fact that his life was going to be short. He was a doctor. And he was coughing up blood from the age of 24. And I think he knew already then that he had this great gift. He wasn't modest in that respect with himself. He knew that he had this gift quite early on because people started writing to him saying, look, you know, you've got to take yourself seriously. It's no good just writing these little sort of comic stories. You know, you're an artist. And it took him some while to get used to the idea. And I think that Chekhov probably valued every minute of his life. I mean, yes, he wasn't an angel. He certainly got up to mischief on occasion. He led people astray, and particularly his many women admirers, many of them were left weeping, I think. He was quite cruel on occasion, but he saw what the position Russia was in. He saw it was heading for disaster, I think. Well, he felt it in his bones. And he knew he didn't have long to live. And I think he just resolved to act wherever he could.
I mean, there is a connection between the diagnostician with a patient and the writer in a provincial town looking at the effects of industry.
Well, that's right. And Catherine Mansfield, if you remember, wrote that wonderful letter for Virginia Woolf saying it's that Chekhov, he hasn't asked the questions, he just puts the question. It's all about diagnosis, isn't it? And he doesn't present any answers, and that's what makes him such a modern writer. And one of the things which Virginia Woolf wrote about when she also discovered Chekhov at that time, you know, wrote about sort of 1918, 1920, was that actually he knows that modern life is really quite uncomfortable and there are no satisfactory conclusions. So all you can really hope to do is to sort of actually diagnose what the condition is. And he does that with incredible precision because he's had this scientific training. But being the good doctor that he is, he's also got this extraordinary compassion too, an insight into human behavior. And, you know, more than any other Russian writer in the late 19th century, he's encountered this huge social spectrum. And we know that, you know, Tolstoy was the great man of the people, but actually Chekhov was the one who had much more direct contact with them. And
he'd seen them naked.
The naked is a very good point. He'd seen them naked and he'd seen them, you know, when they were down as well, and not always when they were on their best behavior.
That was Rosamund Bartlett on Skype from Palermo this week. André de Boost, the writer, Melia Bensusan, the stage director, Maxime Schreier, the scholar, and the Russian are with us in the studio. Melia Bensusan, sorry, your production of The Cherry Orchard this past winter breathed all those Chekhovian qualities that people talk about, that autumnal feeling, the precision of observation and language, also the humor. How did you do it? What's the secret?
Well, I'm honored to be in this company and to be introduced in this way and ask such a question. I have to credit the ensemble work of Actor Shakespeare Project and the ability those actors had to breathe and work together. I think everything that's been said about his transparency and his empathy really comes through wonderfully in an actor's voice, because he had deep empathy for actors as well and an understanding of how little needed to be said on
Hatched
stage.
These plays with Stanislavski.
Right. Well, he actually started with other directors and got them to Stanislavski, and most of them bombed when they first opened, which is a wonderful detail, which I'll turn to our scholar who will know more about this. But I've quite loved to imagine how the plays opened badly and then grew in their popularity. I think in part because the actors were able to breathe in the roles and in the language in a way that the company you saw was able to. What I was struck by with The Cherry Orchard, and which really resonates for me with what André's saying and what Rosamund has been saying, is there are no devils, there are no saints. They're all comic people dealing with really tragic situations, right? As a greater mind than mine once said, tragedy is about the difficult, comedy is about the unbearable. Chekhov wrote comedies. They were about the unbearable, and he had comic characters facing the abyss of their existence and in a very Beckett fashion saying, I can't go on, I will go on. What is the option, right? So in that sense, I do see him as a great modernist. He wrote somewhere in a letter that what he wanted with his plays was to tell people honestly, look at yourselves. Look at what bad, boring lives you lead. That's the most important thing for people to understand. And when they do understand it, they will certainly create a new and better life, a kind of Trofimov, right? The young student in the cherry orchard, the idealist who's made fun of appropriately, you know, within the context of The Cherry Orchard. But I think his ability to empathize with every single person on a stage and to give every actor in any size role in any of the productions, in any of the plays, something that they yearn for and want and yet don't have. In the same way in the clip from Vanya that Larry does so beautifully, that the sense of Wally Shawn and Larry Pine saying, can't I do it all again? There's a line he actually cut from Cherry Orchard, which the spirit still lives in some of the other speeches, where Charlotta, a character who's a nanny in a sense, who's really in a sense out of work now, carries on and says, Luba Andreevna, the mother of the play, our protagonist, is constantly mislaying things. She's even mislaid her own life. And I think Chekhov points out to us our petty tyrannies, our obliviousness, our lack of consciousness and mindfulness and how our lives go by in a comic vein.
The Cherry Orchard, and I should have said this going in, is this story of a family basically coming apart over property, but the money has run out and the energy in a certain way has run out. It is a classic autumnal End of an Era, and it's about Russia in the 19th century. It's about all of us.
Right, could I say it's about anyone who doesn't really want to embrace cause and effect. And it's not, you don't have to be in a fading system or in a shifting government or a shifting mm-hmm. economic system if you simply don't realize that your actions will have effects. And that's what Chekhov is able to sort of poke fun at. But show us, look, if you pay no attention to, you know, the famous Chekhov line is, if there's a gun in the first act, it must go off in the fourth.
Right.
Great theater language. And in a sense, what Chekhov does is in his first acts of his plays, lay out all the things that people should be paying attention to. And then nobody pays attention. And they're repeated and repeated. And nobody pays attention. And in the end, all the guns go off.
Well, the guns do go off, but love is not made very often in the third act.
That's the point.
He called it a comedy.
That, I think, is the point also.
Maxim Schreier, you're the Russian in this conversation. Tell us about Chekhov's Russia or Russia's Chekhov. Where do you want to begin?
I'm the Russian Jew in this conversation.
More than one Russian Jew.
With Chekhov and otherwise. Well, look, Chris, first of all, I want to say it's great to be here. It's always a pleasure to share the table with you. And also, we're in such great company. I do want to say something that I feel very privileged because probably, Chris, you don't remember this. And Andre, you probably don't know this. But about 15 years ago, Chris... your late father, Andre, and I did a Chekhov show.
Oh,
and,
amazing.
I have very, very fond memories of that and of asking the late Andre Dubu what it was that made people think of him as the American Chekhov. So
I just want to remember what he said.
He said several things, and I still have the recording. He was also talking about his daughter, a teenager at the time, I believe, and how she was writing a paper on The Lady with the Lab Dog.
Mm-hmm.
In any case.
Let's get back to that later.
Yeah, so what do I want to say? There are many ways of looking at Chekhov, and what Rose Bartlett said, I think, is absolutely correct. There is a way of thinking about him as a very history and class conscious artist. He was a baby when serfdom was abolished, when the Russian serfs were emancipated. He died in 1904 during the Russo-Japanese War. His career so naturally and logically spans the last decades of the 19th century when Russia was entering modernity, leaving behind its agricultural economy. And of course, there is a way of thinking of Chekhov as a poet of the emerging middle class. But there is, of course, a very different way of thinking about Chekhov. There's as a poet of human vulnerability, as a writer about love's indeterminacy. Mm. And in that sense, if I may, I want to recall a small, but I think very important literary anecdote, which is one that bridges American and Russian culture. And of course, who bridges Russian and American culture so poignantly in Chekhov's case? It's Vladimir Nabokov, who said about Chekhov that he wasn't exactly a great stylist. I disagree. I think he's a superb stylist, but he said he would bring Chekhov and Chekhov alone to exile on an uninhabited island. I paraphrase. So the anecdote I want to share, and I think it's a very telling one. So the year is 1956. Mm. Now, Lolita has already come out in Paris, but has not yet come out in America. So Nabokov has not reached bestseller and stardom, but he knows that he's going to. He's writing to Edmund Wilson, who is probably his most important American interlocutor, a long-time student of Russia, an admirer of
and the language.
Russia and Russian language, culture and Russian history, left-leaning. He wrote to Finland Station, as you know. But in any case, Wilson has just edited a collection of Chekhov stories and wrote a preface to it. Nabokov is dashing off a letter in which he says, and I just want to quote this because I think it speaks to the things that Andre and Melia were just talking about. He says, "Thanks for my predecessor's book. I'm sure his ghost is appalled by the boners in the dreadful translation you have graced with your preface. You can well imagine how strongly I disapprove of your preface. Do you really think that Chekhov is Chekhov because he wrote about social phenomena, readjustments of a now industrial middle class? I thought he wrote of the kind of things that gentle King Lear proposed to discuss in prison with his daughter. So what Nabokov is saying is, sure, of course it makes sense conveniently to think of Chekhov as a poet of Russia's economic and social transformation, but it really doesn't say much about Chekhov's art. And do you remember what King Lear discusses with Cordelia after they've been taken prisoners and taken to the camp at Dover?
It's going to remind me, how sharper than a serpent's tooth is an ungrateful daughter.
It's that majestic monologue, which is one which Chekhov is paraphrasing in a way in Lady with a Lab Dog, in what Andrei just read, mm-hmm. when Anna and Gurov, already lovers, are looking down at Ariadne and thinking about the eternal sea and nature and the frailty of love. And it's the same thing in a way that Chekhov speaks time and again about this paradox of how the most profound things seem to be hidden behind the facade mm-hmm. of ordinary life.
Yes.
The mundane somehow yes. does not represent what we live for.
And, yes. yet if we absorb the mundane, I mean, that's the genius of it, is taking in the mundane as a way to get to the transcendent.
It's a perfect cue for where I wanted to go. I mean, this is a bit of a challenge to you, Andre, from another writer who teaches Chekhov. Kevin Clouther, whom I don't know, left us this message from Stony Brook in New York.
I rarely think about Chekhov's stories while I'm writing, though I often think about them as I'm living, which ought to be higher praise. There is a celebration of existence in his stories that is more than earnest or unembarrassed. It's triumphant, as if the writer is grabbing the reader by both arms and insisting this person lift his or her grubby head to look, if only for a moment, at the world as it actually presents itself. Here is Chekhov in The Man in the Case. It was already midnight. To the right, the whole village was visible, the long street stretching into the distance a good 3 miles. Everything was sunk in a hushed, deep sleep. Not a movement, not a sound. It was hard to believe that nature could be so hushed. When you see a wide village street on a moonlit night, with its cottage, haystacks, sleeping willows, your own soul becomes hushed. In that peace, hiding from toil, care, and grief in the shadows of the night, it turns meek, mournful, beautiful, and it seems that the stars too look down on it tenderly and with feeling, and there is no more evil on earth, and all is well. I forgot that I ever looked at a street like this until Chekhov reminded me. I love when writers do that. The transition from the third person to the second is a gesture I would be reluctant to make, but Chekhov does it so readily and with such confidence that I trust there is something universal here. The last endless sentence does so many things I wouldn't dare, like the accumulation of abstract adjectives, meek, mournful, beautiful, and frank consideration of evil on earth. He isn't shy from discussing the soul. Committing the pathetic fallacy doesn't bother him either. It all reminds me of the last 4 lines I've composed upon Westminster Bridge, September 3rd, 1802, a gem from the other end of the same century. Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Maxime, I'm so glad that you rescued Chekhov from history, so to speak, from economics, from the trend of the moment. I mean, he's out there with Wordsworth, with the greats. One other point, the ultimate tribute to any story writer nowadays is to be called the Chekhov. I mean, Alice mm-hmm. Munro is the Chekhov of Canada, mm-hmm. or the woman's Chekhov. Mm-hmm. Raymond Carver was the Chekhov of the Pacific Northwest. Mm. Andre, you and your father have both been called the Chekhov of, I don't know what, the Merrimack, the New England. But take the challenge that Kevin at Stony Brook just put you. How do we all wake up to that sensibility that Chekhov suddenly hits us with, and can you teach that? Can you teach us?
I don't know if you can teach. Look, to me, I think a good writing teacher just guides a writer to what's not working in his or her work, and then hopefully to what is working. And to me, what's always working is that truth-seeking quality combined with a deep and abiding humility. There's, again, back to Flannery O'Connor, again, a totally different writer than Chekhov, but she's got this wonderful line, there's a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without.
Right.
And that is the quality of having to stare.
That's it. That's great.
Carver, who you just referenced, said, you know, sometimes we must, even though it sounds silly, we must stand and look agape at a shoe. This is, look.
That's wonderful.
Isn't that gorgeous? The writer James Lasden has a beautiful essay about Chekhov in which he says there are two major sort of tonal, emotional tones overarching and in between in Chekhov's work. And he said that's wonder and horror, which is fascinating to me because those are also the same emotions that come up in the presence of mystery, a sense of wonder and a sense of horror. Our very own births, our very own deaths, and everything in between.
And recognition.
Yes, but we have to get back.
The horror of recognition.
But we have to get back to the fact that Chekhov did it through things like the shoe, the cherry tree.
Right.
And as Kevin just said in the scene from The Man in the Case, a village road in the nighttime, and to see through all that melancholy a profound peace in that scene. We're talking about Anton Chekhov. On our website, we asked open source listeners to call in the wisdom that they hear from Chekhov for their own lives. These were some of the responses.
Chekhov would say a lot about our American life, but one thing I'm certain he would say is what he said about Gogol, that we mustn't bring Gogol down to the people, we must bring the people up to Gogol.
Reading about him and that he was a doctor, I realized that there was something doctoring that he was doing in these stories. It wasn't only as an artist, but he was giving medicine in his way through his art.
What might Dr. Chekhov have to say about our American way of life? He might say, how sad, how foolish, how familiar.
Thank you, Bob Brustein. Thank you, Suzanne Petrucci. Thank you, Michael Hammond. And then nobody in the American conversation today invokes Anton Chekhov more often, more fervently than the philosopher and lay preacher Cornel West, the jazz man in the world of ideas, now at the Union Theological Seminary in New York. Here's Cornel.
With Chekhov, you simply do not have a poet in prose of such profound compassion, wrestling with death, disappointment, wrestling with the steady ache of misery, the constant heartbreak of daily life, but trying to convince us to keep on. Ours is in the trying, the rest is not our business, T.S. Eliot says. That's Chekhov. And his blues sensibility. How do you keep keeping on?
André Debus, Melia Bensusan, and Maxime Schreier in the studio. Maxime, goes to you because you brought the vodka. Where were we?
We were talking about teaching Chekhov and the relevance of Chekhov. And I think it's a challenging question because I've taught Chekhov over the years. I've been writing about him and I've been dialoguing with him. And I think there's a kind of mantra that Chekhov is very teachable. I'm not convinced that he is very teachable, and I'm further not convinced that young people fully get Chekhov. I think there is a great deal of subtlety to Chekhov, erotic subtlety and absurdity as well. And I think these are the kinds of things that young writers in America are taught to avoid these days, particularly absurdity. Our editors don't like absurdity very much. So what can we tell young writers? Give you an example. Again, since we're talking about Lady with a Lab Dog. So Gurov and Anna are in Yalta on the embankment. They are expecting the arrival of a steamship, and Chekhov drops this detail, which appears to be a sign of verisimilitude, but it's the opposite. He says that there were many generals in the crowd. So I always tell my students, guys, just imagine for a moment, how many generals are there altogether? Well, how many generals are there in the Marine Corps? And now imagine how many generals can there possibly be on one autumn day in Yalta on the embankment. So what is Chekhov saying to us? There were many generals in the crowd. And these are things that are quite incomprehensible. And from there, we jump to Gurov, who's chomping, on watermelon to the accompaniment of honest tears of self-flagellation. Chekhov does not describe the lovemaking. They go to a room. The room has this smell of Japanese perfume. There is a gap of silence. And then the next thing we know, Anna is crying and saying she's a fallen woman. And Gurov is eating watermelon. Try teaching that.
I would put in a plug for the plays here. I'll defer to my distinguished colleagues in fiction.
But we're having fun.
Right, but I think when audiences come to the plays, those details, that level of nuance gets captured by an actor. And the language is transparent. And so there's watermelon in The Lady with the Dog, and in Cherry Orchard, there's a cucumber out of the blue. Mm. Someone speaks of their existential angst,
that's right,
and then munches on a cucumber. And it's a brilliant moment, and it's completely Chekhov, and it's a way of saying, oh, please, don't take yourself so seriously. Yeah. I'm certainly not going to take myself so seriously.
And Vanya, shut up,
exactly,
as the doctor says. Andre.
I want to get to Maxime here. So, yes, I actually do not care if my students quote unquote get it, because I truly believe that any work of art worth the salt is worth 1,000 interpretations or more. What you just raised one of my favorite moments in all of literature, and that is this woman has just cheated on her husband. She's in this post-coital remorse, sitting on the bed, and we're in Gurov's mind and heart. He's growing bored with this remorse.
Right, right.
He reaches for a slice of watermelon and eats it. That one gesture, again, character action, is so telling and essential. You know, back to this whole notion of Chekhov as a stylist, I tend to agree that he was. I don't think he was a great stylist. I think what he was great at, though, there are so many things you have to parse out, but he was an absolute master at isolating and delineating that essential detail. That one detail of Gurov seeing the watermelon, reaching for the slice, and chewing it while she wept says everything about Gurov and men of that time.
Well, can I throw one more thing about that story instead of a play?
I want to know what it says about Gurov.
The wonderful thing about that story is my read of it, and this is all, I'll claim the interpretive seat here, but is that they're really not in love. And they convince themselves when they return to their lives that they're each other's great love. And I think the genius of Chekhov is he captures the fact that they could each be perfectly happy in their lives, really. Mm. But what they've done is you watch in their own imaginations this engendering of a lack, of a yearning to give meaning to their own lives, as though the lack of something makes them more important. And I think he's sort of poking fun at them, because at the end they both end up, she's weeping at the end in the hotel room, right? And they debate endlessly, instead of making love, instead of having a good time, they debate endlessly how things will get better, and at the end they realize it will be forever before things get better. And I think it's a wonderful portrayal of love, not as simple, not as purely romantic as in the plays, but this complicated mix of our own imaginations, our own desire for meaning in our lives, and our projection onto others.
I agree, Milia.
totally.
But what I want to say is, it's a somewhat trivial comment, but I think...
Nothing you say is trivial. Go ahead, Matthew.
Thank you, Chris. I do think, and I'll give you a small anecdote after that, that you do not read Chekhov as a young man the way you read Chekhov as a person with a broken heart, as a parent, as a person who is bereaved, a person who is displaced. I think, and I can tell you, when I was a young person, a young poet trying my hand at writing short stories in what used to be the Soviet Union in the early 1980s, this episode irritated me because I thought Chekhov was preaching. Whereas now I read it as a meditation.
Yes, it is a meditation.
But it takes years and it takes experience. And I just want to share one small detail. My father, who is a writer, David Shrive Petrov, just published his 25th book, which I edited and co-translated. It's called Dinner with Stalin. And we were working on a blog together. And my father said something very interesting to me. He said, and I said, Dad, you used to love Hemingway. You had Robert Frost portrait in your study in Moscow. And he said, it's true. But somehow he said, I don't know what it is, but I only love Chekhov now the way I don't love any other writer. Mm-hmm. And he said he has that vibration of feeling. It was a very interesting phrase, vibration of feeling. And it was 3 days ago, and I'm still mulling over that.
Wow.
And I think that Cornel West is onto something.
Yes, the blues.
I think the poet of prose is just right. Chekhov as a poet.
Andre Debus.
Well, it makes me think a lot about Keats's famous line about Shakespeare and negative capability. I mean, we all know that came from young Keats seeing a Shakespeare production and just being incredibly moved by it. And he was walking with a friend, a poet friend, and he was wrestling with out loud, why is this man so great? And he wrestled with it all night, and he ended up writing a letter to his brother the next day where he defines he had this ability to step into negative space.
Oh,
what he meant
wonderful.
Was nothingness, doubts, mysteries. Yes. And his exact phrase was, without any irritating reaching after facts or reason.
Oh, I love that.
Okay, look, if you look at the word fiction, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it actually comes from the Latin fictus, and it means to fashion or shape. I find that to be a fascinating definition. And we all know that there's some level of artifice in story making. You know, we pick something and we drop something else on and on. One of the things I'm constantly up against, having tried this daily, I mean, it's all I want to do is write something great. I'll admit it out loud on the goddamn radio. is there's a level of artifice that Chekhov and every writer faces. And yet you must, it's a fine balance you ride, like a surfer rides a surfboard. It must not be artificial, though.
Right.
Somehow, why are Chekhov's stories completely unpredictable when you read them for the first time? Why do you never know where they're going to go?
Well, it's right. Because he was weary of the artifice.
Yes.
He was weary of the artifice, but I would suggest to you he had the same nascent power as Shakespeare, and that he was able to step into nothingness without an agenda, and the hell with facts and reason.
I love that. I mean,
and the hell with religion, too, he told Tolstoy.
I mean, well, but that, I think there's more to that. There's more to that.
But the I love comparing it to Shakespeare. I mean, we joked a little bit with Cherry Orchard because it was Asp. The artistic director, Alan Burroughs, said at one point, now we'll work on the pauses. We're not going to act on the line. Mm-hmm. We're going to act in the pauses. And I teased him, and now here I am teasing him on the radio because it's not true in Chekhov. You're acting on the lines. You're in the moment. The negative space is created for you by him. And that is the mystery. Nothing happens in the plays. There is no plot to speak of. There's a cherry orchard. They have to sell it. At the end, they sell it. And yet, your heart breaks by the end of the
play. I just want to throw in a reminder for all of us that for all the melancholy in Chekhov, there is also the consolation, often the lift. Mm-hmm. In fact, the exhilaration that comes with Chekhov, too.
And cheer.
I'm thinking specifically of the story called The Student. It was so-called, said to be Chekhov's favorite. Harold Bloom writes, "The student is ardently simple, though beautifully arranged. A young clerical student, cold and hungry, has been out hunting on an afternoon evening in April. He comes on two widows, mother and daughter, on Good Friday. He warms himself at their campfire and tells them the story of how the Apostle Peter denied Jesus three times, as Jesus had prophesied. Peter, returning to himself, wept bitterly. And so does the widowed mother, as he tells the story. The student goes off and he broods on the relation between the apostles' tears and the mother's, which seemed to him linked in an unbroken train. So here's the end of what Chekhov called his favorite story. Now the student was thinking about Vasilisa. If she wept, it meant that everything that had happened with Peter on that dreadful night had some relation to her. He looked back. The solitary fire flickered peacefully in the darkness, and the people around it could no longer be seen. The student thought again that if Vasilisa wept and her daughter was troubled, then obviously what he had just told them, something that had taken place 19 centuries ago, had a relation to the present, to both women, and probably to this desolate village, to himself, to all people. If the old woman wept, it was not because he was able to tell it movingly, but because Peter was close to her, and she was interested with her whole being in what had happened in Peter's soul. And joy suddenly stirred in his soul, and he even stopped for a moment to catch his breath. The past, he thought, is connected with the present, in an unbroken chain of events flowing one out of the other. And it seemed to him that he had just seen both ends of that chain. He touched one end, and the other moved. And when he crossed the river on the ferry, and then, going up the hill, looked at his native village and to the west, where a narrow strip of cold crimson sunset shone, he kept thinking how the truth and beauty that had guided human life there in the garden and in the high priest's courtyard went on unbroken to this day and evidently had always been the main thing in human life and generally on earth. And a feeling of youth, health, strength. He was only 22. And an inexpressibly sweet anticipation of happiness, an unknown, mysterious happiness, gradually came over him, and life seemed to him delightful, wondrous, and filled with lofty meaning. That's the end of Chekhov's favorite story, The Student.
Here's the
thing. Bring it home, Andre.
Here's the thing about being a writer. You cannot hide.
Right.
When your work is read or produced, you cannot hide where it came from. It came from you, the writer. What is so clear, you know, before that beautiful reading, Maxine was talking about there's hope in these stories, and there was joy all through that. But you know what suffuses that passage, and frankly what I think suffuses Chekhov's entire body of work, is love. Mm-hmm. Love. Love for all of us.
Right.
Love for the beauty of the cherry orchard. Love for the way the light hit the 17-year-old girl's face in the moonlight. Love
For mortality.
Yeah, love for mortality. Love for the fact that we're dying. Love for the fact that we must be alive before we're dead. You know, the word compassion comes from Latin. It means to suffer with.
Right.
And nobody suffers with his characters more than Chekhov. I'll tell you what, by the way, my father, that is, I think, why it's a very apt comparison. My father, Andrzej Debuse, the late great short story writer, also had, I think, equal reserves of compassion.
Maxime Schreyer.
I agree. Love and vitality. When Chekhov was dying in Badenweiler on the 15th of July, 1904, his wife describes, he said in German to the doctor, "Ich sterbe." He asked for champagne,
right.
and he died. To me, if you think of that as creating closure of the story of one's life, it's Chekhovian, by which I mean it is about love and about the fullness of vitality. But Chris, to get back to you about The Student, My teacher of Chekhov, Robert Jackson, who's probably the greatest American critic of Chekhov, used to say that the story is not about religion, it's about women. And the main characters there are not the seminarian and not the characters of the Gospels, but these Russian women who are weeping at the telling of the stories. And I think there is truth to that, as is to the fact that his last story, The Bride, Nivesta, is about a young woman who is leaving her hometown as a young American student going off to college, thinking that she would never come back.
Right.
But of course, she would return many times, and we all know that.
Well,
but the last note of the story is that uplifting sense of leaving home.
One more little Chekhovian detail. Malia first.
Malia. Talk about being on the spot. I would just say that the humility and the wit of his characters. He has a great line in one of his letters where he talks about how in one of the plays he describes the characters as speaking through their tears. And what he doesn't mean they're crying. He means they imagine that they could cry, but they never cry on stage. it would be tedious to watch other people cry. He had a great sense of humor and a lightness of spirit in the work, I think.
I wanted to mention, Rosamund Bartlett told us that Shostakovich, as he was dying, asked his wife to read Chekhov's story, Gusev. So the assignment is go home, everybody, and read Gusev, one of the great, great stories.
And then read them all.
And then watch Vanya on 40 Seconds.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you, Malia Bensusan. Thank you, Andrzej Debuse. Thank you, Maxime Schreyer. Also Rosamund Bartlett, Kevin Cluther, and Suzanne Petrucci. We are all Chekhovians now. You can hear our series of 7 podcasts, Actors and Friends, reading and discussing some of the classic stories at our website, radioopensource.org. Please listen in and join the conversation with a comment. Special thanks also to the audio maestro, Jim Donahue, who recorded those stories. Next week, we're reviving Edmund Burke to lead the coming Republican Revolution with David Brumwich of Yale. We're going out on Uncle Vanya, sung by the Soviet songstress Claudia Shulzhenko. Our show this week was produced by Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, our engineer George Hicks, with help from Matt Ellis and Will Madhouse. Mary McGrath is our resident Chekhov. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
Дядя Ваня хороший, пригожий. Дядя Ваня всех юношей моложе. Дядя Ваня чудесный наш толстяк. Без дяди Вани мы не на шаг.